to visualize a different kind of planet. And I think the primary mechanism of doing that is just talking like we are now and explaining and determining what is going on, sharing our information, because none of us have all of this information. Believe me, there's a lot of things going on that I'd like to know that I don't know. But by sharing and communicating about what is going on the planet, I see as a primary mechanism that we can actually change things. That's why I bother to be down here, whether it's how much good is accomplishing here. Maybe I can't even judge that, or maybe I'm not even supposed to try to do that. But anyway, that is simply a base source for me of hope. 464-8295. We're getting down to the last few minutes of the show here, so if you want to call in, 464-8295. Well, another little thing about here, the presidential election's going on. It seems like any time any of the main Democratic contenders get up and speak, it's very difficult for them to not put their foot in their mouth. We had Dean last week, talking about looking for the good old boys vote with the Confederate flag and the pickup trucks and so forth. Anyway, there's quite an exchange. Now, Kucinich is a Democrat that's running, and I certainly don't agree with everything that he's promoting. Certainly, universal health care right now, given the fact that the corporations are basically dominating the government and dominating health care, it would not be very wise to put our health in the care of an institution called government that's been so detrimental to our health. So there's certain things I would disagree with him, but I think he's basically a sincere person. I think he's a thinking person. I don't think he's necessarily part of the establishment. And it's very interesting to see how they always want to promote the CFR types, Council on Foreign Relation types. All the last presidential elections, last 50 years or so, we just had one CFR member on one side of the fence debating another CFR member on the other side, and lo and behold, no matter who wins, we still have the same policy. Big surprise. So I think Kucinich is out of that loop. I don't think he's really deep into the bowels of the hidden government, if you will. He's kind of an outsider. And the way I feel about it, I would vote for any outsider. I would definitely vote for Kucinich above Bush a thousand times over, because Bush has an agenda. And what's that agenda? Well, it's this one world government. It's the idea of a totalitarian government. And Kucinich, whether his policies good or bad or indifferent, at least I think he's sincerely trying to help people. And I think someone like that, who's by chance he's going to be doing some good things now and then, but someone who has an evil agenda, which I think Bush does through and through, will only and every time be doing that which is detrimental to the United States. So anyway, I was driving down to work, and I heard this little exchange. They played a little exchange between Ted Koppel and Kucinich, and basically Kucinich got on, and he was trying to. They were having the usual back and forth, and Ted Koppel trying to set the whole agenda. He was talking about. They had all these presidential candidates there, and he was talking to them, well, what do you think about this endorsement and who's the head and who has the money? And he was basically setting the tone of the whole debate there, and there wasn't any real debate. And Kucinich jumped in and said, hey, you're talking about a lot of side issues here. Let's talk about real issues. Let's talk about the war in Iraq. Let's what good or bad or indifferent. Let's talk about health care. And he really nailed Koppel, and at that point the audience just broke out clapping and sustained clapping and so forth. It was a great taking down of Koppel, and a good one. He's certainly like Peter Jennings, really needed. Again, Peter Jennings, Ted Koppel, also a Council on Foreign Relations member. These people, they have their agenda. And is it any surprise that nothing seems to change as we go into these presidential elections, as we go into one administration after another? Nothing's really changing. Government is growing. It's becoming more centralized, more authoritarian, more interfering in the daily lives of Americans. It's really one of the greatest threats to world peace and to the peace of the average citizen out there is the federal government. 75 years ago, people didn't really think much of the federal government. They didn't see any evidence of the federal government. It wasn't a part of their lives. Just wasn't an issue for most people. And now you find yourself filling out form after form. We have federal agents deciding when and where they can invade in Santa Cruz here, like up in Davenport. It's not a very healthy situation. Well, I see we're at the end of our program here. Blessings to you all. Think about the great birthday this week.
Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Peter Lance. We're going to be talking about his book, A Thousand Years for Revenge. And this is really the best book we have to give us the background of the bombing of the World Trade Center back in February of 1993, and how this whole plan kept unfolding from then, actually planned by exactly the same person, ended up with the attack on the World Trade Center on September 11th, 2001. It's an amazing story. Takes you into the background of the government's involvement. In fact, you sort of wonder how anybody could be totally inadequate and make so many mistakes as our federal government did time and time again, snatching defeat out of the jaws of victory. Mr. Lance, thank you so much for being with us today. Mr. Lance, are you there? Is Peter Lance on the line? Looks like everything's in good shape. I'm going to ask my producer. Oh, I didn't have Mr. Lance yet. Okay, that's the reason. So I'm going to go ahead and put him on. We seem to have... what's that? Okay, fine. Well, he's not answering either telephone. So, well, maybe it's just going to be an open line tonight, which is fine. I'll have our producer continue putting the calls in. But right now I'm just going to give you just a moment or two of music, and then I'm going to go ahead and give my producer a couple of telephone numbers, and then I'm going to be back here, and it'll be open lines. Give us a call if you'd like at 464-8295. Or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. But right now, a little music, and we'll be right back with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and so I'm just going to do an open line program this evening and welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But the talk we were going to give tonight with Peter Lance, a fascinating, fascinating book, going into the background of what led up to the attack on the World Trade Center. Now, you have to understand that there was a man named Imad Salem, S-A-L-E-M, and he was an Egyptian army officer, had come to the United States, had been either a major or colonel in the Egyptian army, but he came to the United States and he wanted to sort of do something that was worthwhile. He was very much of an Egyptian patriot. He was very angry with the Egyptians who had killed Anwar Sadat. He thought Sadat was a great Egyptian leader. And when Salem came to the United States, he, of course, went and talked with many of the Muslims. He himself was a Muslim. And he found that there were some very, very radical groups in the New York area that were actually plotting revolution. Well, Salem was working as a manager at a hotel, and there was a young woman named Nancy Floyd, and she was an FBI agent. She actually was looking around for evidence of a communist infiltration into our government and communist diplomats who might very well be working and having some impact here. This was in the early 1990s. And so she had actually asked Salem if he could give her any information on some of these Soviet diplomats, which he did, and did a great deal of good information for her. And then, as she was talking to him about, you know, this communist infiltration of the United States, he said, you know, if I were you, I would be far more interested and concerned about the radical Islamic people here who are planning a violent acts here in the United States. Well, she was actually working on communism, not necessarily on Islamic radicalism here, but she became quite intrigued with what Mr. Salem said, and so she went to the Joint Terrorism Task Force, who was operating in New York at the time, gave them Salem's name, and of course they contacted Salem. They asked him if he would mind working for them, infiltrating the Islamic movement here. Now, you've heard over and over again, oh, we didn't have anybody in the Islamic movement. We couldn't get anybody in the Islamic movement. Well, they had people in the Islamic movement back in early 1992. And so Salem was given a stipend of money, not a great deal of money, maybe $500 a week, and his job was to infiltrate the Islamic movement. And he actually got to be very, very close to the blind sheikh. That was Omar Rahman, and Sheikh Omar Rahman, and he found that these people were planning on planting explosives all over the New York area. And in fact, because Salem had actually worked with the Egyptian army and had some limited knowledge of the building explosives, they wanted him to build 12 pipe bombs that they were going to plant all over the city of New York. So Salem told the people he was working with, and they were people on the Joint Terrorism Task Force. Some of them were with the FBI, others were with the New York Police Department, what was going on, and suggested the people who should be arrested. Well, Salem had taken the job on one condition, and that was he wouldn't have to wear a wire. He would not have to testify, because, of course, if he were to be found with a wire working within these radical Islamic groups, they would have killed him. If he was forced to testify, not only would his life be in danger, but that of his wife and children, who were back in Egypt. And, of course, he was sending them money. And so he was willing to do what he was doing because he really loved America. He wanted to do something significant for America. I mean, you don't risk your life for $500 a week. It was not a matter of money. It was a matter of doing something that was worthwhile. And here he is. He's right in with this group. And, you know, if you get to know the names of all of these people, many of these people were the people who were involved just a few months later with the bombing of the World Trade Center in February of 1993. So, you know, in comes a new director of the FBI into the area. And he is a very insulting, supercilious individual, and he demands to see this this Egyptian officer. And, you know, and here's a man, very cultured, he speaks multiple languages. He goes into the FBI office. First of all, they insist to go into the FBI office, and everybody says, we don't want him to go to the FBI office. Somebody might see him going in there, could cost him his life. And the head of the FBI says, I'm telling you what to do. I'm in charge here. So the man, against his better judgment and against the judgment of Nancy Floyd, who really is sort of his handler, she's doing this on her own time. She's already working full-time on the communist aspect, and then she's spending the evenings, instead of enjoying herself, working to talking to Mr. Salem on a regular basis. And the Egyptian Salem goes to the FBI office, goes to see the head of the FBI, who's sitting with his shoes off, cross-legged on a couch, and demanding that he wear a wire. And Salem said, I didn't agree to do that. I mean, well, you're going to do what I'm in charge here. I'm going to tell you what to do. And Salem said, no, I'm not going to risk my family's life. And, well, you're going to have to testify. And he said, I'm not about to testify and risk my wife's life and my children's life. Well, I don't trust you. You're probably just, and the man was just so insulting to this very cultured Egyptian. And the story, as we've heard it, was the fellow from the FBI was just crude, and he was in charge, he was the boss, and you either do it my way or it's the highway. And so Mr. Salem said, well, I'm very sorry. I mean, they're planning on planting bombs all across your city, but I'm not going to continue working there if you insist I wear a wire, if you insist that I, you know, testify publicly and risk the life of my wife and my children. So he bowed out. He just gave up his stipend, got a job working, and left this group. But he kept talking to Nancy Floyd, and he kept telling her, you've got to do something because these people are planning an attack right here in New York. And he even told who they were. There was a fellow named Abu Halima, and he was known as the Big Red or Red. And there was a fellow named Salami, and there were several others that he gave the names of who these people were. And they were the ones, of course, who'd wanted him to build the bombs. Now, also, Mr. Salem was very, very concerned. He had been asked to record conversations, and so he had actually taped conversations with the FBI. So he would not they would not turn on him and try to make it out that he was a terrorist. He didn't trust the FBI anymore. They'd lied to him. They told him he would not not have to wear a wire. He would not have to testify. Suddenly they were saying he would. And so he began taping his conversations with, of course, Nancy Floyd. And much later, after the February bombing, 1993, he began taping his conversations with other FBI agents. Well, anyway, as you know, it was February of 1993 when suddenly there's this gigantic explosion. A car bomb goes off in the basement of the World Trade Center. $500 million damaged, 6 people killed, 1,000 Americans injured. And the FBI had a man on the inside of this movement, and they drove him away. And, of course, they insulted him. And, of course, now what are you going to do? Well, when Joanne White, who was the district attorney there, she was the federal prosecutor in the New York area, learned that had a man on the inside, she said, "You get that man back. We've got to have somebody on the inside of this Islamic terrorist movement. We've got to find out, first of all, who was involved, and secondly, what else they may be up to." And so they brought Salem back, and they made a deal with him. Instead of paying him $500 a week, they paid him $3 million to infiltrate the Islamic terrorist movement. He did, under those circumstances, agree to wear a wire and agree to testify with a promise that his wife and child and he himself would be placed in a witness protection program and that he would be protected by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. So Salem then went back into the Islamic terrorist movement, and the FBI had actually identified the key people in the plot to blow up the World Trade Center, and they were all the people that Salem had told them about. Big Red, Abu Halima, Salem, Salami, I should say, and several others. And, of course, we've actually interviewed Mr. Robert Preston, who was the defense attorney for Salami, and gotten that aspect of it. But there's no question these people were all involved in the plot. However, the master bomber, a man named Ramzi Yosef, and another man had escaped. In fact, Big Red, Red Abu Halima, had escaped to Egypt, and of course he'd been arrested by the Egyptians, had been tortured, had confessed everything, and then been sent back to the United States. But they couldn't use the confession based upon torture, and so they did have to hold a trial there. And eventually, of course, they were all convicted and sentenced to life imprisonment. But Ramzi Yosef, who was the mastermind behind building the bomb that destroyed the World Trade Center, escaped, and he went back to Pakistan, where he lived in a building that was owned by a man named Osama bin Laden. And, of course, his uncle was a man named Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and he we refer to today as the mastermind behind the September 11th attack, and he was apprehended about 6 to 9 months ago. That's Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. But you have to understand that the plan wasn't Sheikh Mohammed's. It was Ramzi Yosef, the master bomb maker. And this is, of course, what the story, Peter Lance's story, 1,000 Years for Revenge, it really is all about. Well, let's get back to Mr. Salem. Mr. Salem infiltrates this Islamic cell. These are radical Islamic people. They're headed by a man named Sheikh Omar Rahman. That's Sheikh Omar Rahman. And he, was a terrorist leader in Egypt, who was brought to the United States by, of all people, the Central Intelligence Agency. Now, he was a known terrorist, and we brought him to the United States, and he was allowed to operate here, fomenting terrorism in New York and setting up a terrorist cell and actually killing people in the moderate mosques so that he could take control. He was behind the killing of Kahana, the head of the Jewish Defense League, and yet they only, instead of going for the conspiracy, they only convicted one man, a man named Nasser, and they didn't even convict him of doing the murder, even though he was the murderer. Why they got him on some other trumped-up charge right after the murder of Kahana, they go to Nasser's home, and who should be there but Red Abu Halima and a couple of the other people who were involved in all these other terrorist attacks. And what does the FBI do? Absolutely nothing. They confiscate 40 boxes of books, and many of these boxes contain top secret United States Army training manuals. Other parts of the 40 boxes are the plans for a radical Islamic revolution and terror in America, but they never bothered to translate these records that are all in Arabic. And since they can't read Arabic, they just totally ignore them. Well, I mean, time and time again, they did the wrong thing, and the CIA brings the blind Sikh to the United States, and he is working with this radical Islamic group, giving them permission to go ahead and attack our military, to bomb the Brooklyn Bridge and the Harlem Tunnel. And, of course, fortunately, Salem is there, and he gets the information. He actually gets, he's carrying a briefcase that has a tape recorder inside, and he actually gets the blind Sikh to talk about how important it is to carry out these terrorist attacks. And based upon the information that was collected by Mr. Salem, why they were able then to arrest the members of this Islamic terrorist cell, and eventually they were all convicted and sent to prison and all given life sentences. And there were a fair number, or maybe a dozen or so people associated with that. And this is the blind Sikh who is still in prison in New York. But remember, he was brought to the United States by the CIA. Now, what is the significance of that? Well, because he was the normal leader of this whole world Islamic radical movement, Islamic fundamentalist movement. There were three people involved. The number one man was a man named Azam. And he had been the mentor of Osama bin Laden until Osama bin Laden had Azam killed. And then the number two man would have been the blind Sikh, and he was over in Egypt. But the CIA brings him to the United States, which leaves guess who in charge of the whole worldwide radical Islamic movement that became Al-Qaeda? None other than our good friend Osama bin Laden. Now, is that simply coincidence that it seems like the CIA is pushing Osama bin Laden into key position? Is that simply coincidence that Osama bin Laden has the leader of this radical movement, Azam, killed? Azam, I don't know how many of you have actually seen the video, Jihad in America, but if you have a chance to get it, why it's put out by Stephen Emerson, and in that you'll actually see pictures of Azam here in the United States in 1988. 1988, 5 years before the attack on the first attack on the World Trade Center, and Azam is talking about here in the United States at meetings in Oklahoma and all across this country of violence and how we have to have blood flowing in the streets of America, and we'll have to cut off arms and legs so that Allah will have feet to stand on, and all sorts of incredible things. Azam was over here fomenting violent revolution in the United States. And isn't it interesting that he's allowed to do this, and they're setting up terrorist training camps? They had 80 centers here in the United States, according to Stephen Emerson, and these were 80 training centers. They actually had three training camps where they were training young Muslims. Well, we're going to have to go to a break here. Well, where they were actually training young Muslims in rifle practice, training them in bomb making. Right here in the United States, and the FBI knew about all of this and did absolutely nothing about it. And you have to ask yourself why. And then, of course, the CIA brings Rahman over here. But eventually he ends up in jail. And everybody thinks, well, that's the end of it. But what they don't know is about Ramzi Yosef. And Ramzi Yosef is really one of the most significant characters of the last decade. Ramzi Yosef, of course, had been trained at a camp in Afghanistan in bomb making, and he was trained by the people who had been trained by your CIA, by your tax money, when we were financing the Mujahideen and training them in terror and all sorts of learning to kill. We trained these people, and we not only that, but we indoctrinated them in the radical form of Islam in the 1980s, between 1980 when we began financing them in 1988, 1988 when the Soviets left Afghanistan. But we trained them in bomb-making, and the people who trained Ramzi Yosef were trained by the best terrorists in the world, the CIA. And so it was that Ramzi Yosef learns how to build bombs, and of course his first big bomb was the one that was used on the World Trade Center, and it was basically a nitro diesel bomb. It worked very efficiently. He went back to Baluchistan, which is a subdivision of Pakistan, escaped in 1993, and then actually tried to kill Prime Minister Bhutto of Pakistan. So he didn't kill, really worry whether he was killing Americans or whether he was killing other people from Pakistan. After all, she was a woman, and she was very offensive to him, and he was given a contract for $68,000 to kill Prime Minister Bhutto. He tried several occasions, failed there. He actually then went to Bangkok and tried to blow up a building there. Fortunately, that failed. He did actually blow up, and I think it was probably in Afghanistan. I'm not sure if it was, but he blew up a Shia mosque, and perhaps it was in Iraq. But he actually blew up a mosque. He was paid by the Sunnis to blow up a Shia Muslim mosque. But then he went off to the Philippines, and this is where the story really gets very interesting. He was in the Philippines in 1994, and he had a plan at that time. He was going to kill the Pope, who was going to come over there. President Clinton was going to come. He planned to kill him. He laid out a plan by which they would actually bomb a number of major jets, a number of 747s. They planned to blow up 12 747s. Actually, Ramzi Yousef made a bomb, and actually was controlled by a small wristwatch, acted as a timer. They put it onto a plane. The whole idea was you got on the plane, you put the bomb underneath the seat, and then, of course, when the plane stopped at the first leg of its journey, you got off, somebody else got onto the plane in your place, and as the plane then went out over the water, the bomb would go off and blow a hole in it. Well, the first bomb that he set off worked very well. He put it together in the restroom, installed it, and of course one man was blown apart, a Japanese, and was sucked out. We'll be back here in just a moment to go on with the story. So this was the plan. They would actually plant bombs on five planes, but there was another plan, and this was known as Bojinka. And Bojinka is a Serbo-Croatian word, a Serbian word, Croatian word for the Big Bang. And this was actually the plan that was going to be used by which they were going to hijack a number of airliners here in the United States, and they were going to crash them, and they were going to crash them into the World Trade Center, into the Pentagon, into the White House, and the Sears Tower in Chicago, and the Transamerica building in San Francisco. This was all planned. This was exactly what they intended to do. And the plan was laid out by Ramzi Yousef. Of course, after he was apprehended in 1995, it was implemented by his cousin, pardon me, by his uncle, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And, of course, that was what happened on September 11th. Well, with us is the expert on this field, Mr. Peter Lance. Peter, thank you so much for being with us this evening.
Hey, Doctor, it's always great to be with you. I'm sorry I wasn't with you right at 8 o'clock.
Oh, well, we've just been given a little summary of this, but you'll do so much better a job of giving our listeners the background of this incredible story of what led up to the bombing of the World Trade Center in February of 1993. But many of the same forces and same ideas were at work that led up to September 11th. So it didn't really start on September 11th. It started back in 1993 or even before.
It started actually in the late 80s, to be honest with you.
Right. So why don't you tell the story?
Okay. Well, the precursor to what happened both attacks on the World Trade Center in 1993, the bombing and the attack of 9/11, were both... the seeds for those attacks were planted in the mid-80s in Afghanistan. And as you know, we had what we considered, America considered, the good war, the good covert war, as opposed to Iran-Contra, the Contra war. This was the war against the Soviets that the Mujahideen Afghan rebels were fighting. And because it was kind of the last gasp of the evil empire, and it was the Vietnam of the Soviet Union, we through the CIA got heavily involved in supplying the Mujahideen, and it was considered a good thing, smart foreign policy move, and I'm sure history will consider it as having been a good campaign for the United States to have been involved in. However, at the time the Soviets were dispatched in 1989, Osama bin Laden, who was a young Saudi billionaire of Yemeni roots, but the scion of this enormous construction empire, the Bin Laden Group, one of the the 17th son of this billionaire Bin Laden. He'd become a radical Islamic at some point in the 80s and had gone to Afghanistan and actually brought heavy equipment over there and helped them build roads and tunnels and helped considerably the group that was known collectively as the Afghan Arabs. And the Afghan Arabs were essentially Islamics from all over the world that came to support the Mujahideen. This was their Spanish Civil War, if you will.
But weren't they actually trained and financed by the CIA?
Well, yeah, there were the CIA, in an effort to help the Mujahideen against the Soviets, reportedly brought $3 billion with a B worth of equipment and arms and training, etc. And they were supposedly matched dollar for dollar by the Saudis. So you have, you know, $6 billion in covert aid, if you will.
Now, but didn't we also teach them how to build bombs and all of these terrible things?
Yeah, we taught them how to. You know, reportedly now, this is, you know, I wasn't there, but, you know, the best we can do, and especially when you're dealing in black operations like this, is, you know, look at what has been said by responsible intelligence sources. And it's believed that the figure of 500 Stinger missiles was given to them. It's believed that they were trained in all kinds of covert operations and bomb-making skills, etc. And that what happened was, blowback, and blowback is an intelligence term for an unintended consequence of a covert operation. In this case, the unintended consequence was this jihad 12-year war waged by Bin Laden and his group against the United States, the West in general, and us in particular. And what happened was the tragic error that U.S. government made in 1989, and this would have been on the watch of George Herbert Walker Bush, the president's father, the massive blunder that was made was that we pretty much turned our back on that theater of operations after the Soviets were dispatched. And Bin Laden had allied himself with one Abdullah Azzam, a Palestinian scholar, who had created this, well, fundraising network. And we can get in. It sounds like you have a break coming up.
We'll be back here in just a moment with Peter Lance. His book, 1,000 Years for Revenge, and this is a very important book because it will give you tremendous insight into what really happened and what led up to September 11th. An entirely different slant that you're going to get from most sources, so just hang on there. We'll be back here in just a moment at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story. And right now, of course, I want to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and if you listen to our programs and you agree that there is a problem and you're not getting the full story through the regular media, we hope that many of you will seriously consider becoming a member of the Radio Liberty family of supporters, which is how we're able to do what we do 5 hours a day on the radio and shortwave and internet and satellite, as we reach out across America trying to get people to understand that there's much more to the story than they're getting from Rush Limbaugh or Bill O'Reilly. And there are people out there who've really done the fundamental research, as has our guest this evening. And so if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, it's as easy as picking up your telephone and calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Now, if you'd like to get a free copy of our newsletter, of course, we'd be glad to send that to you. And our December newsletter goes into the background of the controversy over Judge Roy Moore. What really happened at the Judicial Hearing Commission that removed him as Chief Justice of the Alabama State Supreme Court? What was the background behind the Supreme Court's decision going back in the 1960s to take God and prayer and the Ten Commandments out of our schools? What was their motivation? And, of course, as you begin to look behind the scenes, you get an entirely different picture, just as when we talk about the background in 9/11. If you just take what happened, you don't see the picture. Any more than you can many times see the forest for the individual trees. But if you begin looking behind the scenes as to why the Supreme Court took God and prayer out of our schools. You'll get an entirely different context. So if you'd like a free copy of our December newsletter, we'd be glad to send you one. Of course, you can pull that down, or you will be able to, in just a few days off of our website at radioliberty.com. And we recommend that everybody who has a computer go to our website at radioliberty.com, where you can actually hear our programs 5 hours a day and not get a thing done. And then after the 5 hours, you can go to our archive programs, and this program will be archived, and you can listen to that as well. But we hope that you'll listen to as many of the programs as you possibly can. And remember, we're on the Genesis Network, we're on the American Freedom Network, we're on the Radio Liberty Network, the Sunshine Network, the American Christian Network. We have an outreach, and if you'd like to become part of our effort, once again, the telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Please tell your friends about our programs. Tell them about our website, Radio Liberty. Well, I guess this evening is Peter Lanson. He's giving us the background of what actually led up to the attack, the first attack on the World Trade Center. And he was talking about a man named Azam. And Azam had actually been here in the United States setting up fundraising mechanisms. He was well known that he was doing this back in 1988, Stephen Emerson's video. A Jihad in America actually has videos that were shot in 1988 going into what was going on here. The FBI knew what was going on, and for some reason, they did nothing at all about it. So you pick up the story from there.
Well, I think, you know, in retrospect, the reason the FBI gave them a pass was that they were, at the time, they were our allies, you know, and this is a familiar theme, which we can get to later with regard to Saddam Hussein. You know, people who are, we find Americans, government find to be in our best interest one day, turn out to be the evildoer the next day, and the foreign policy doesn't seem to be consistent, unfortunately. But anyway, getting back to this, Abdullah Azzam had a network, a brick-and-mortar worldwide network of fundraising centers to raise money for the Mujahideen called the Services Office, or the MAK, and it was all over the world. And in the U.S., they had outposts in Brooklyn, in Detroit, in Big One in Tucson, and a number of them in Europe. And they were raising millions, Dr. Stan, every year, millions and millions of dollars in cash for this rebel war effort in Afghanistan. Well, after the Soviets were dispatched, the question is, the money kept pouring in, so the question is, what do they do with the money? Well, bin Laden had a falling out with Azzam, who was the founder of the network. Azzam wanted to use the money to set up a Taliban-like fundamentalist government in Afghanistan, but bin Laden had the worldwide jihad in his mind. He had much broader goals, and he was supported by a group of radical Egyptians. And in my book in particular, I talk about the key. If you want to understand the key to 9/11, you can go to my website, peterlance.com, and get the book that way. If you want to understand the key to 9/11, you have to understand that this is not about Iraq. It's not so much about the Saudis as it is about these radical Egyptians. They surrounded bin Laden, and the men are, and I have a timeline in my book, as you know, in the middle of the book, 32-page illustrated timeline with all their pictures, so it's like the little golden book of terror. You can follow along. You had Abdullah, you have Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri, the fellow who reportedly issued a threat tape just last week. He was the one seen in the video of bin Laden a few weeks ago. Mohammed Atef, former police officer from Cairo, reportedly killed in Afghanistan in November of 2001. And then blind Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, one of the most dangerous terrorists ever to come to the U.S. They supported bin Laden in the takeover of the MAK network because they wanted to use the money, part of it, against Mubarak in Egypt. What happened was, in November of 89, Azzam, on his way to Friday Juma prayers, was killed in a car bomb with his two sons. It was like a mob hit, in my opinion, and I believe bin Laden did it. So suddenly they have this network now, brick-and-mortar outpost that became Al-Qaeda. And one of them was in Brooklyn, New York, at this Al-Kifa Mosque. And lo and behold, Dr. Stan, the FBI had it on their radar screen in July of 1989. On four weekends, they followed a group of MEs, Middle Eastern men, out to a shooting range in Long Island, and they photographed them firing AK-47s, etc. Of that group of men in 1989, three went on to bomb the World Trade Center. Two went on to plot to blow up the bridges and tunnels around Manhattan with the blind sheikh. One killed Rabbi Meir Kahane in November of 90. And one, the leader, Ali Muhammad, another Egyptian, did the surveillance for the African embassy bombings 9 years later, and all these guys were on the radar screen of the New York office of the FBI in 1989.
Now, wasn't Ali Mohammed the one who was actually in our own military?
Yeah, he was a triple agent. He is a book into himself. He was had been a radical member of the same unit that had killed Sadat in 1981, but his excuse for his alibi was that he was in the U.S. Kennedy Special Warfare School at Fort Bragg at the time, training the Green Berets. He got out of the Egyptian Army, went to the U.S., emigrated, joined the U.S. Army, became a sergeant, went back to Fort Bragg, and on weekends, with a secret security clearance in the U.S. military, he was going back and forth and training these guys who would later become members of Al-Qaeda to bring the war on the United States, to bomb the World Trade Center and create so much dread. And he literally pretended at one point to be informing for the FBI on the West Coast, and the FBI thought he was working for them when in fact he was training bin Laden's bodyguard in Khost, Afghanistan, and then he literally picked the spot where bin Laden pointed his finger and said, "That's where I want the bomb for the African embassies in 98, where 234 died." So, I mean, again, these guys were so capable, and the FBI and our government misunderstood them to such a degree. They thought of them as ragheads. They used these pejorative terms, loosely organized group. Even in the New York Times and the Washington Post, you still, as late as a year after 9/11, they were referring to the original Trade Center bombers as a loosely organized group. My book, A Thousand Years for Revenge, proves, I think, beyond a reasonable doubt, that they were an absolute cell of Al-Qaeda, financed by bin Laden with the blessing of the blind sheikh, and that the first attack on the Trade Center in 93 was a precursor. 2 years later, Ramzi Youssef is in the Philippines plotting to blow up the Trade Center again, only this time with the 9/11 plot. The U.S. government knew about it. It was given to them by the Philippine authorities, and they dropped the ball.
And, of course, it was given to them in 1994.
95, April, actually.
It was actually April of 95, because I thought that they arrested Ramzi Youssef in 94.
They arrested him in February of 95.
Murad, I should say. Right.
Yeah. February 95, but he was plotting with his uncle Khalid Sheikh, who the FBI now calls the mastermind of 9/11. He was plotting the entire thing. They had 10 men training in flight schools. They had 6 targets, including the Transamerica and the Sears Towers, right? I mean, they were going to hit the heartland in addition to the Trade Center, the Pentagon, and a nuclear facility, and the CIA headquarters in Langley. This was an incredibly elaborate plot, not to be confused, as is often done with the Bojinka plot, to blow up airliners. That was a completely separate plot, and there was a third plot to kill the Holy Father, John Paul II, as he went to the Philippines. So, you know, Ramzi, as I say in my book, was the Mozart of terror. He was an outside-the-box thinker. He was so far ahead of anybody that we had on our payroll, and he was just completely underestimated.
All right. Now, then, it was when was Murad actually arrested there in the Philippines?
What happened was Ramzi was from an area called Baluchistan, which is kind of an area the size of France that intersects Iran, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. And he grew up in Kuwait. His father was in the oil business, and one of his lifelong friends was a guy named Abdul Hakim Murad, another Baluchistani. And the three of them, with his uncle Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, grew up in Fulya Hill, this town in Kuwait. What happened was Abdul Hakim, while Ramzi Youssef was getting ready to come to the U.S. to blow up the World Trade Center in 1992, already his friend Abdul Hakim had been to 4 U.S. flight schools. In fact, he boasted to the Philippine interrogator, Colonel Mendoza, who I interviewed. I've done the most extensive interview with Colonel Mendoza ever, I think. And he boasted to him that I picked the Trade Center as the target. He went to flight schools in New Bern, North Carolina, Schenectady, New York, Red Bluff, California, and outside of San Antonio, Texas. 4 schools, got his commercial pilot's license in 91 and 92. Now, the Bojinka plot that everybody always talks about, that he was ultimately convicted of along with Youssef, was a plot to smuggle like bomb-making triggers on 2-leg hops, U.S. planes coming in from Asia to the U.S. You didn't have to be a pilot to do that. You know, anybody could have done that. And so that plot was completely separate. This guy, Abdul Hakim Murad, went to these flight schools. Now cut to the Philippines in 1994. He's there with Murad. Murad is there with Youssef, with Khalid Sheikh, and with a guy named Wali Khan Amin Shah, who was a Uzbeki, who was beloved of Bin Laden. They called him the Lion. He fought in Afghanistan. He was kind of the operations guy. And the four of them were plotting to kill the Pope, who was going to be there on the 13th or so of September. Then they were going to do the Bojinka plot. They were going to plant. Each of them was going to plant a bomb on four flights, up to a dozen flights. And then they were going to, get off the flight, and the plane would go on and blow up weeks or months later. And then finally, when they had enough men trained in U.S. flight schools, they were going to do the 9/11 plot. And in fact, Murad boasted to Colonel Mendoza, "I will fly the plane into the center myself for Allah. I will die for Allah." He was the Muhammad Atta, if you will, of his day. Murad, Yusef's friend, was going to be the lead pilot. And literally, what happened was an act of God, as this Filipino policewoman said to me. She said, on the night of January 6, 1995, they were in their bomb factory in the Philippines mixing up a series of devices when they had a smoke fire that was just billowing smoke came out of their room, and they rushed outside, and Yusef ultimately fled that night, but Murad was captured through some dazzling police work that I have in my book. I have the most complete, I think, story, you'll agree, in the book. It's a real page-turner. It's kind of like a thriller, how the Murad was captured. Yusef escaped with Khalid Sheikh to Islamabad and was brought to ground a month later. But here's the amazing thing, and this is another extraordinary blunder by the feds. Yusef is in a 20-room guest house, which we now know is controlled by Bin Laden. Only 20 rooms, not a Holiday Inn, not a big hotel. And Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is on the ground floor. While Yusef is arrested by federal agents, Khalid Sheikh gives an interview to Time magazine using his own name, and Time quotes him a week later, and then he leaves. Then the feds don't even think to check every other room in the guest house, apparently, and Khalid Sheikh escapes only to go on to execute his nephew's plot. Amazing.
And this is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was actually, they were in this building owned by Osama bin Laden in Pakistan or Baluchistan at that time.
Pakistan, Islamabad, right.
Okay, so now let's get back to what was actually this special plan that they had in 1995, by which they were going to attack the World Trade Center, the White House, the Pentagon, the Sears Tower, and the Transamerica building. Now, you've actually talked to the police officer who debriefed the right. Came up with this, found this on the right. on the laptop computer, and he right. told the United States government that there was a plan to attack the World Trade Center with the planes.
He told them with great specificity. In fact, if you go to my website, peterlance.com, when Dan Rather did two pieces on my book in September, he aired a video. I actually have videotape of Colonel Mendoza. And the video, you can play with Windows Media Player off of my website. And Colonel Mendoza said to me, in the beginning, of course, it took him 67 days to unwrap this guy. You know, he just didn't cough this up immediately. First, he talked about a plot to fly a small plane into the CIA. And that was all most people ever knew of this plot, because they admitted that a small beginning of the plot, they admitted that into evidence at the Bojinka trial in 1996. So the press knew about a plot to fly a small plane. When Condoleezza Rice stood up on the 14th of May of 2002 and said, in paraphrasing, "No one could have envisioned anyone hijacking planes and using them as missiles," she and others at the time were saying, well, you know, there was just a little plot to fly a small plane into the CIA. But what Colonel Mendoza told me, that's what Murad told him in the first couple of days. But as the weeks went on, and he had him for 67 days in interrogation, threatening to turn him over to the Mossad, so Murad was terrified that he would go to Israel, and he ultimately coughed up the intimate details of this 9/11 plot. It was a much more elaborate plot. It was the 9/11 plot. They had it in motion. They had, as I said, 10 men training in flight school. So Mendoza told me that he turned it over to the U.S. Embassy in April of 95. He would not tell me who, because he didn't want to embarrass whoever it was. But here's the astonishing thing. On the day of 9/11, Colonel Mendoza was in northern Philippines, where he now works, and was doing a report, and it was 13 hours ahead. And when he was text messaged on his little Nokia cell phone, "Urgent, turn on CNN." He turns on CNN only to see the South Tower fall. And the first words out of his mouth, "They have done it! They have done it!" In other words, you know, it wasn't even a question for him. He was so convinced that this plot had been, that the feds were, had foiled this plot because he gave them the information. He was shocked beyond belief. This was not some casual thing. He was very, very specific in telling the U.S. authorities about it. And many people in the Philippines in law enforcement knew about it. In fact, when I interviewed Colonel Mendoza, he told me about the that the Trade Center and the Pentagon and the CIA were targets, but or the Pentagon and the nuclear facility. But then Bobby Tiglao, who was the secretary of the President Ramos in the Philippines, he later elaborated to CNN, to Maria Ressa, that in fact the Sears and Transamerica towers were also a part of it. So it was widely known among law enforcement in the Philippines that this plot had, and they just assumed that the U.S. feds would do their job and stop it.
Well, of course, they're right after the 9/11 attack, why the Washington Post sent four reporters, that's four reporters, to the Philippines to track down this story. And they came back and they said there really was a plot to crash a plane into the CIA building.
Yeah, but they say
nothing was. How could they possibly not know about the plan to fly planes into the World Trade Center?
Okay, not only did the Washington Post get it wrong in the sense of being limited to that plot, but the Joint Inquiry of Congress. If you look at their report, they only talk about the small plane into the CIA, and you see. There's a spin that goes on. What's been going on since my book came out is this spin. The spin doctors come on because these men have blood on their hands. Okay, I've said this and I'll say it again, and I'll say it with great specificity. The New York office of the FBI, in particular, they have blood on their hands because they were warned with great specificity about this plot, and what they've tried to do is diminish it and say that it was just a plot to fly a small plane in the CIA. And as I told you, these guys from the Washington Post weren't talking to Colonel Mendoza, obviously. And I did, and I got a long interview with him in the presence of Maria Ressa from CNN. And I want to praise her. I went out of my way in my book to praise her because Maria Ressa, who happens to be a Filipina-American, went to Princeton, is the bureau chief in Manila for CNN. She actually had a piece on the 18th of September on CNN, and it got buried, Doctor.
I mean,
it got ignored.
Somebody spiked the story so the American people wouldn't know about the plan to hit the World Trade Center?
I think there's been so much spinning on this story that, I mean, let me give you an example. I have, you know, in my book, with great specificity, the fact that Youssef and his uncle plotted this in 94, okay? About 2 months ago, John Solomon, who's an excellent reporter for the AP, about as good as they get, a chief investigative reporter, was given a story by, quote, intelligence sources, in which he supposedly, they were talking about what Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who, you know, was arrested in March of 03, and he's supposedly being interrogated by U.S. authorities, and he began talking about the plot. John Solomon is reporting and nationally for the AP that Khalid Sheikh is saying that the plot was started in 1996, okay? He's moved it further now, 2 years further, according to the AP. And again, Solomon is just reporting what he is hearing from these intelligence sources. Then the London Sunday Times, a few weeks later, does a piece in which they're claiming Khalid Sheikh is saying it was 1998 was the genesis of the plot. What I believe has happened is since my book came out, because I took the, what I did was I took the story back so far and I said, could they have stopped Ramzi Youssef in 1992? And I think you've read the book, you're one of the most knowledgeable people on this book. I think you'll agree that I proved quite definitively that they could, the FBI could have stopped Youssef in 92. If they'd stopped him in 92, they would have prevented the original bombing and 9/11 because Youssef was a criminal genius and no one else would have come up with this plot. I guarantee you, if you believe in the great person theory of history, Ramzi Youssef was the key to 9/11, okay? And by bringing it back, now the FBI, what do they want to do? They want to distance Khalid Sheikh Mohammed from his own nephew. Why? Because if he and his nephew did what Boogie Mendoza said they did in 1994-95, then the FBI has blood on their hands in the New York office because they failed to stop him in 92. So you see how they're spinning it now. They're trying to push it further back, like that Khalid Sheikh is the mastermind. Nobody's mentioning Ramzi Youssef anymore, even though Ramzi Youssef was at least the equal of his uncle, if not smarter, and Ramzi Youssef was the bomb maker. Khalid Sheikh wasn't a bomb maker. Khalid Sheikh, he was an operational guy, and he was a very capable person, but the idea that he would have originated this 9/11 plot is just absurd.
Well, no, yes. At one time, right after 9/11, didn't Ramzi Yosef, there sitting in prison, wherever he is, really very excited that this had actually occurred?
Well, I have, I think, the only account of Yosef in prison, and I got it from some very confidential sources, that how he observed 9/11 that day. He is in the Supermax, the most secure of all federal prisons, for 240 years. That's how long he's locked down for. And, I have, I think, as I said, this extraordinary account. He was visited by two FBI agents that morning from the Colorado Springs office, but basically told him nothing. Now, he knew that the plot was in motion, obviously, because he put it in motion, but he had no idea when it would take place. He'd been incommunicado in solitary since 1997, at least. But one of the most interesting things that came out in the joint inquiry, and that I have in my book, actually, it was broken by the New York Daily News, was that the FBI was so desperate to get something out of Yosef in 1996, they actually recruited a mobster, a member of the Colombo crime family, who was on the 9th South of the tier of the Metropolitan Correctional Center, the federal jail in Manhattan. And this guy, Greg Scarpa Jr., was in a cell next to Yosef, and he got to be friendly with him because they exercised together. And the feds actually created what they call a phone patch-through, where they allowed Scarpa to make outside calls, and they knew that Yosef would take advantage of it, and they were going to monitor the calls. And Scarpa did this in return, ostensibly for, some time off his sentence. And what it turns out that Yosef, stung the feds, and Yosef was able to figure out how to do this where he was unmonitored. Well, at one point, he got a call out in 1996 to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. He was able to contact, according to the joint inquiry, it's believed he was able to contact Khalid Sheikh. Now, that's 1996. Who knows what was said, and who knows what may have been communicated about the 9/11 plot, but apparently Yosef was able to contact him. And I, as you know, I have a chapter about Oklahoma City and TWA 800, lest people think I'm a wide-eyed conspiracy theorist. I think I've got some pretty extraordinary evidence linking Yosef to both of those, and I think the call may have had something to do with TWA 800, because Yosef was on trial for the Bojinka plot, and TWA 800 was the embodiment of the Bojinka plot.
Well, now, what was the relationship between Yosef and, of course, the bombing of the Oklahoma City? We're told, oh, this was just a lone nut, a right-wing pro-militia fanatic, Timothy McVeigh, and, of course, he did have a little help from Terry Nichols, but right. What's the tie-in, then, between Twosome and, of course, Ramzi Yosef and Sheikh Mohammed?
Right. Well, the as you know, Nichols and McVeigh, by the testimony of Michael Fortier, who became a major witness for the government, that was one of their best friends, they had no bomb-making experience. In fact, they tried to set off an ammonium nitrate fuel oil device in a metal milk jug in the fall of 94, and it fizzled like my 16-year-old son could have done a better job, okay? And yet the next time they set off an ammonium nitrate nitromethane device, same essential chemical, kind of composition, they took down the Oklahoma City Federal Building, the Morrow Building. So what happened? What was the intervening event? How did they get so smart? Well, Terry Nichols was married to a Filipina named Marife Torres. She was the daughter of a police officer in Cebu City. And Cebu City is this obscure, relatively obscure town in the southern Philippines. It's a hotbed of Abu Sayyaf, which is the Al-Qaeda group in the Philippines, a hotbed of radical Islamic activity. And Terry Nichols had made four trips with no visible means of support in the 1990s. Had made four trips to the Philippines. He happened to be in the obscure little town of Cebu City at the same time as Ramzi Yosef was. For sure, we know he was there for a few hours in December 11th, 1994, because he planted a bomb on a Philippine Airlines flight that flew from Manila to Cebu and then on to Narita. And Yosef wet-tested, as he put it, this Bojinka plot and almost took down a 747, killed the Japanese national who was sitting in C-26K where he planted the device. He was one row short of the center fuel tank, and the plane didn't crash, didn't blow up, but almost did. So he knew the plot. He knew he could at least make this work, this plot called Bojinka, which is Serbo-Croatian for big noise, by the way. That was another one of Yusef's little details that he added to the to history. So anyway, Ramzi Yousef is in the Philippines, we know at that point, and also Edwin Angeles, who is an Abu Sayyaf leader who later turned state's evidence. I have a sworn affidavit with his thumbprint that he was in Davao City in the southern Philippines in the early 90s with one Terry Nichols, a.k.a. the farmer, Ramzi Yousef, and Abdul Hakim Murad, the same guy we talked about earlier. This is a sworn affidavit, and there are many other pieces of evidence suggesting Nichols had contact with Yousef, and that's how Nichols and McVeigh learned to build a bomb.
Okay, well, we're going to a break here at the hour, but I just want to review this for our listeners. Basically, here's Ramzi Yousef and Sheikh Mohammed and Murad and their meeting with Terry Nichols. Now, this is a very, very strange situation, and we really want to get into this much more because there's no way that the Nichols and McVeigh could have built that bomb without information from somebody who knew how to do it, and the master bomb builder of all time was a man named Ramzi Yousef, and of course he was in the Philippines at that time. Edward Angeles was number two man, a co-founder of Abu Sayyaf there, and of course that's a whole different story. Maybe we can get into that some other time. But right now, of course, we're going to have to remind our listeners in the Great Northwest that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and if you believe in what we're doing, we hope many of you will give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, give us a call at the same number, 1-800-544-8927. We encourage you to go to our website at radioliberty.com. Tell others about our website, about our programs, and then, of course, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival, because if this country doesn't turn back to its Judeo-Christian roots, then the America we've known will cease to exist. Because remember that human societies, like human beings, live by faith. And when faith dies, they die. And die when faith dies. So we'll be back again tomorrow evening at the same time. Until then, may the Lord be with you. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and I'm going to ask our guest, our producer, to see if we can get Peter Lance back on the line, because we were just in the middle of the story here, and we don't want to lose him. So, Andy, if you wouldn't mind calling Peter back again. I hope he didn't think he was done for the evening, because we planned on going for 2 hours. But this is one of the most incredible parts of the story. Edward Angeles, of course, where I've read, was actually a Filipino government agent. He was the co-founder of Abu Sayyaf, this wicked Islamic terrorist movement over in the Philippines, also formed in large part by the Philippine government. Because after all, when you ever have the terrorist over there, all you have to do is talk about terrorism, and the Americans will give you all sorts of money and military equipment and training. And so it was very advantageous for the Filipino government to have the terrorist movement there. But Edward Angelus had the opportunity then to actually meet, apparently, with Terry Nichols, who was known as the farmer. And I think that's one of the most fascinating parts of this whole incredible story. And this was never brought out at the trial, the Timothy McVeigh trial, or the trial of Terry Nichols. And you have to ask yourself why. Have you ever talked to Stephen Jones, who defended Timothy McVeigh?
Oh, yeah, I interviewed him extensively for my book. In fact, I think he gave me one of the most extensive interviews that he has given, and he said some amazing things. He said that he had intended his main defense for McVeigh would have been that, in fact, that Youssef taught him how to build a bomb. Of course, McVeigh would have resisted it because he wanted to go to his grave as the great bomb-making mastermind. But Stephen told me, and he actually faxed me, I didn't put it in the book, but he actually faxed me a diagram. One day, you can picture what they call a woodshedding session, where the lawyers and the investigators are sitting around McVeigh trying to figure out what the defense is going to be, and they're sitting around and questioning him. Tim, how did you learn how to build a bomb? It's very evasive, and they ask him to draw a picture of the device, and he draws something like a kid could have drawn. It shows like a square or a rectangle representing an overview of the truck, the Ryder truck. By the way, remember the parallel, yellow Ryder truck delivered this bomb to the federal building, rented out of state, just like Youssef's signature in the World Trade Center bombing. Anyway, you look down at this truck and you see some circles representing canisters of nitromethane, etc., and a couple of little lines drawn between them like fuses, and it was like a comical little stick figure kind of a device. It was something any kid could have imagined. It didn't show any knowledge of bomb making, any complexity at all. So Jones says to him, "How did you learn, Tim, how to do this?" He said, "Well, I learned it from a book in the Kingman, Arizona library." And they said, "Well, what was the book, Tim?" And he said, "I can't remember the name." "Well, when did you check it out, Tim?" "Well, I can't remember." So then they sent the investigators up to Kingman, Arizona Library. Of course, there was no book, okay? Because he didn't learn how to build a bomb from that book. That bomb, he got the knowledge to build that bomb through Ramzi Youssef, through the Middle East connection. And there is an incredible guy named John Berger, and I would encourage people to go to his website. His website is Who is John Doe? number2.com. Who is John, J-O-H-N-D-O-E, number, I guess it's, well, I don't know. If you look it up under Google, you'll find it, the letter2.com. And John has done some fantastic reporting on this. He's about to break a story that suggests that in the early 1990s, the Rodney Clement Hampton L., who was one of the guys from Calvert in Long Island I was talking about, one of the Al-Qaeda members who had fought in Afghanistan and who was part of the Blind Sheikh's cell in New York City. Rodney Clement Hampton L. was actually reportedly visited the Saudi embassy in Washington with a member of the U.S. military. And right after the Gulf War in 1991, the Saudis set up tents in the desert to, quote, educate American troops about Islam. Now, on the surface of that sounds like a good idea, right? We're facing a new threat in the world. You want to find out. Well, guess what? The Washington Post had a piece in November that said over 1,000 U.S. GIs converted to Islam during that period. The mullahs somehow convinced them that Islam was a superior religion. It's the largest wholesale conversion of anyone in the U.S. military in American history to this religion, okay? And it is believed, and we haven't nailed this down, I'm working with John on this, that a list of names of American troops who might be friendly to the cause, quote-unquote, were given through the Saudi embassy, through this American military officer, to Rodney Clement Hampton L. And it's possible, we don't know this for sure, it's possible that McVeigh and or Nichols may have been on the list.
Now, was that John Berger, B-E-R-G-E-R?
B-E-R-G-E-R. If you do a Google search, John Berger, who is John Doe number two, and I think it might be John Doe, N-O, the numeral 2.com.
All right.
But anyway, he's a remarkable investigator, and he's broken some amazing stories having to do with Jose Padilla, the alleged dirty bomber who was in the news last week, and he's an excellent investigator. Well, anyway...
We've got a caller. Let's just take Paul's question. He's been hanging on very patiently here. Okay. Paul, did you have a question or comment?
Yeah, I had a couple questions. I guess one would be Oklahoma, and then there's 911, but I don't know if you have time. I'll start with Oklahoma. I saw some video footage, probably 20 minutes of multiple newscasts describing multiple bombs being found in the building, and showed pictures of guys going in there with trucks, you know, defusing these bombs, and a bomb expert saying that when we take a sample of this explosive material, we'll be able to tell by the blast cast how they're arranged, the material they used, who built these bombs, where they got the explosives.
Yeah, we actually have those videos available through Radio Liberty. The film footage is actually shown there. So, but I think that's a little off of the subject here, but I think it's a fascinating aspect of this, because we've never really gotten the truth about what happened there. But that's getting a little far away from where we've been going.
And by the way, if there were devices planted, and there are those that feel that even in the World Trade Center, there some people theorize secondary devices. The point is, it doesn't invalidate the Yousef Nichols theory. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
It's just, you know, it just is another explanation for how the devastation happened, but it doesn't invalidate that. And look, there's another theory, of course, which may be used by Nichols now. He's going to have a local trial, which is the Elohim City thing. And the Elohim City, as you know, is the supposedly there were these white radical militants in this area called Elohim City, and the, you know, one of the theories is that they had munitions training, and that McVeigh was out there at one point and he got some training. But again, if you look at the origin of John Doe number 2, if you look at the original witnesses that saw what described the Middle Eastern man fleeing the scene, the fact that the Bureau went after John Doe number 2 and then quietly dropped it, and you look at the fact that, amazingly, Abdul Hakim Murad, Yousef's partner, on the 19th of April, the day of the bombing, he was in the Metropolitan Correctional Center in New York, the same jail that Yousef was in that had the patch through, and he claimed credit for the Oklahoma City bombing on behalf of the 5th Battalion Liberation Army, which was Yousef's unit. Spontaneously, as soon as he heard on the radio that there had been this blast, we did that. And the FBI actually came and did a 302 memo, which I have part of in my book, that showed that he took credit for it. So there are just so many intriguing aspects of and potential links.
Okay, on 911, how did they get the Pentagon? Anytime a plane flies more than 15 degrees off course, the Pentagon is notified, and the Pentagon has SAM sites to defend it because it's our military headquarters, and none of those SAM sites went off.
That's what my new book is on. My new book is on the day of. So you'll have to wait for me to answer that one.
But I'll tell you what, Paul, Peter has all sorts of wonderful new material, because he's, of course, working with the wives of the victims of 9/11. So when the new book comes out, this is really going to be a corker. Have any other questions?
The only thing was that the ATF didn't show up the day of the Oklahoma City bombing, and was wondering why none of their employees came that day, when other people did show up at the door.
Well, I think that there's a lot to that story that we are not being told. Hey, we're going to have to go because I don't want to get...
Check out my website, peterlance.com, and the book is 1,000 Years for Revenge. And I ask people, I'm doing a little commercial here, but I ask people to get educated. If you read the book, I think you'll get the best quick overview you'll ever get on Al-Qaeda and the threat. And, you know, in that way, you'll get educated and you can put pressure on our leaders to... So the 9/11 Commission will get to the truth.
And I agree with you totally. And from Paul, who was calling in, your questions are all excellent. The material you have is excellent. But I don't want to get too far away from this subject. And perhaps we can discuss those other issues some other evening. Anybody would like to see those videos he's talking about, we have them. It's called Cover Up in Oklahoma City. But let's get back then, that there's no question in your mind, after having talked to Edward Angeles, who incidentally was killed shortly after you talked
to him. I didn't talk to him. I have a sworn affidavit of his.
Okay, we got that from the Philippine police or what?
Yeah, I got it from sources in the Philippines.
All right, we won't pin you down, but we know that Edward Angeles was subsequently killed, wasn't he?
He was killed, yeah. And you know, and he's been impeached because there was other unreliable information. But all of these informants, look, they tried to impeach Ahmad Salem, Nancy Floyd's extraordinary asset that infiltrated the Sheikh cell, Sammy the Bull Gravano, all the guys that have the capability of infiltrating and turning and giving evidence are always liars. They always have questionable bona fides. But the question is, in the end, what's the quality of the intelligence they give on any given subject? And when it came to Yousef, what he said dovetailed with a number of things that were known about Yousef and Nichols' movements in the Philippines. So And ultimately, I think you have to, you get back to the physics of it. You know, where did these guys get the capability to explode that kind of a device? And why would the judge limit the case? Why, suddenly does the case focus exclusively on these two guys and not allow Stephen Jones to have his theory, you know? And I think part of it was the Justice Department had them, and they didn't want to go looking for any second gunman on the grassy knoll, so to speak. You know, they had a case, and why complicate it with Middle Eastern elements? But that was the same mistake that was made in the trial of El Sayed Nasser for the murder of Kahani. The local New York police chief of detectives Borelli wanted to call it a lone gunman case to avoid a political show trial. Well, in fact, it turned into a major show trial when Nasser hired William Kunstler. And the truth is, a incredible opportunity to get onto Al Qaeda in the fall of 1990 was lost. So again, there's always this problem, this conflict between intelligence gathering and criminal prosecutions. And there's been some progress made since 9/11 in that area, but the Justice Department, the fatal mistake over the years was treating these incidents as a series of cases to be won, thinking the threat would be diminished. And again, underestimating the enemy, just incredible.
But I think the most frightening thing about the Timothy McVeigh trial was not the fact that the Justice Department didn't want the information to get out, but that the judge refused to allow Stephen Jones, who was Timothy McVeigh's attorney, to put in his defense. In other words, the judge was in on this thing, and as Stephen Jones wrote in his last book, Others Unknown, The Oklahoma Bombing Conspiracy, the most disturbing thing was I realized you can't get a fair trial in the United States. He was prevented by the judge from bringing in the facts about Terry Nichols going over to, and he had some of this information you've talked about, and he felt that he'd been in contact with the Islamic radicals over there, and he felt that they'd learned to build a bomb over there, and he wasn't allowed to bring that out, or so much of the other information that the government got to the judge, and the judge fixed that trial. Now, this isn't to say that Timothy McVeigh wasn't guilty of sin, because I think
right.
he was.
Right.
But they did not want the American people to learn the truth, and that's why I think your book is so vitally important, because you don't pull any punches.
Yeah, well, what's interesting? My book is embraced by conservative people who consider themselves conservatives and extreme liberals and progressives. You know, I mean, it's amazing. I just got in a great write-up on Newsmax. I was on with Jeff Metcalf on Friday night, who was a very conservative talk show host, and yet I've been on with Amy Goodman, who has this democracynow.org, which is a very much of a left-wing kind of a program. And the reason is, the other thing is, my book was also praised by both Al Hayat, the Arab language newspaper in London, and Al Haratz, the Israeli Hebrew language paper in Tel Aviv, the same week. And I think it's because I didn't enter this with a political agenda. See, Richard Minotaur, who I've debated on Amy Goodman's show, has this book called Losing Bin Laden. I don't want to sell him any books. He went into this thing with blinders on. He just decided he was going to do a Clinton bash, and he didn't want to examine the evidence that impacted negatively on either Bush, on either end of Clinton. Now, most of the negligence happened during Clinton's presidency, not a question about it, and my book focuses on that. But I went in and I kicked over the rocks and I reported the story as I found it. I didn't go in and say, well, I'm going to exclude this evidence and that evidence. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, I agree with you totally. I interviewed Minotaur several times, and you know, he's a nice man, but very, very circumspect in what he had written. Now, let's get to the TWA 800, because you also cover that. And, I mean, here all of these things are intertwined with this incredible story. So where does TWA 800 get in? Coming to this, because we've never been told the truth about that either.
Yeah, I think the TWA 800 story, I think if a compelling case could be made for Yusuf Connection Oklahoma City, it is 10 times more convincing with respect to TWA 800. Now, if you recall, and I don't know how many people were listening in the first hour, but I talked about this Bojinka plot that in the Philippines in 1994 and 95, Yusuf and his uncle Khalid Sheikh and Abdul Hakim Murad, his lifelong friend, a commercial pilot trained for U.S. flight schools, had in mind to do three plots. Kill the Pope, who's going to come in January, this Bojinka plot, and then the 9/11 plot. And the Bojinka plot involved the construction of these intricate little bomb-making triggers. This is what a genius Yousef was. He went from building weapons of mass destruction to be moved to a location in a truck to blow up, and he tried to blow up the Israeli embassy in Bangkok the same way he had done the Trade Center, and you could argue the same way they did the Oklahoma City. He came up with this ingenious idea to smuggle the components of a bomb onto a jumbo jet exiting Asia with American tourists into the U.S. On a two-leg hop. So the guy would get on, the conspirator would get on with these innocuous elements. If you go to my website, peterlance.com, and you get the book and you look at the timeline, you'll see that I have for the first time pictures from this FBI report that was so controversial that the FBI seized a copy of it that was on its way to John Solomon of the AP from a FedEx facility in the Midwest in the fall last year. If you can imagine, seizing a package that one journalist in the Philippines was sending to another, the AP, we're not talking about Mother Jones here, we're talking about the Associated Press. There was nothing a national security threat in that package. That report had actually come out in two separate federal trials. It just hadn't seen the light of day. And I got a copy of it, and I published pictures in my book from that. And the pictures don't give anything away, but they show in one case this extraordinary watch, this Casio watch with some wires coming off of it, and that was going to be the bomb, the timer, if you will. And then basically in a shaving kit with what looked like contact lens cleaner was actually diluted nitroglycerin and some cotton balls that make it nitrocellulose, the high explosive, and a 2 9-volt batteries that Yousef had smuggled in the heels of his shoes, get smart, you know. The fact that you have to take your shoes off when you go onto a flight today is not because of Richard Reed, the shoe bomber. He learned that trick from Ramzi Yousef, who did it in December 11th, 1994. That's how he got his two batteries on through the metal detector, because they didn't start but for an inch off the ground, so he was able to walk through. And he built this device on the first leg of a two-leg hop from Manila to Cebu City, same town Nichols was in at the same time. And he put it in the life jacket cushion in his shaving kit in seat 26K and got off. A Japanese national gets on, the plane takes off, boom, on its way not far off of Okinawa, almost crash lands, kills the Japanese, and it's one half a meter south of the center fuel tank in the Boeing 747. Okay? Now, he had intended to put it over the center fuel tank, and he miscalculated by one row, because it turns out the fuel tank starts along row 25. All right? Now, cut to Yousef is captured. We're in 1996. He and Wali Khan and Murad are on trial. Now, the fourth co-conspirator, Khalid Sheikh, is on the loose. Okay? Yousef, we now know through the Joint Inquiry Report, is able to get a call out to Khalid Sheikh sometime in 1996. On July 17th, on the eve when damaging evidence was about to be entered at trial, and Yousef was representing himself, not doing a bad job for a non-lawyer, but clearly the weight of the evidence was against him. The jury was about to hear everything that you just heard me say about this specific bomb being smuggled on board, the 747, row 26, the whole thing, okay? On the night before, TWA 800 takes off from JFK, bound for Paris, and just as it clears Long Island airspace, boom, there's a catastrophic incident, and then a millisecond later, the plane blows apart. It, clearly, there had been a red herring, and many people believe there was a missile that was friendly fire from Navy testing, or that terrorists had shot it down with a SAM, but that's really impossible given the velocity of the plane and the position it was. No SAM, no land-based SAM, the surface-to-air missile could have hit it. But they did find, and there was no evidence when they assembled 95% of the plane in a hangar on Long Island, there was no evidence of a missile piercing, but there was RDX, PETN, and nitroglycerin found all over the plane, high explosives. Now, how did the FBI explain that? The FBI, which to their credit in the beginning believed that there had been foul play and believed that Yousef and his clique were at the top of the list, and James Kallstrom, to his credit, the former ADIC of the New York office, dispatched 700 or 800 agents out to prove that this bomb theory. But the NTSB from early on, from very early on, decided on a mechanical theory, because there had been a similar 747 that had spontaneously blown up on a runway after a short, an electrical short, in the center fuel tank, and it had ignited vapors and the plane blew. So their theory was this had happened.
Now, that wasn't the plane that was over in Thailand, was it?
No, it was actually on a runway somewhere.
Okay.
It was actually in an airport. And it was three or four planes removed from the fatal 800 flight on the Boeing assembly line. You know, it was very, very closely built at the same time. But they had determined that there had been some frayed wires in that had caused a short. In this case, there was no evidence, none, absolutely no evidence. It's like the single bullet theory. It's like they decided on how it happened, and they decided to shove the evidence and fit the evidence to justify it. And the NTSB, the metallurgist, the chief metallurgist of the FBI, sided with the NTSB when only 10% of the plane had been assembled. I don't know how the guy ever could have made a judgment at that point. I interviewed Kenny Maxwell, the former supervisory special agent who was the key guy assembling the plane out at Calvert in Long Island. Ironically, Calvert in the same same location as those MEs from 1989 firing weapons. It's just a coincidence. But they had a hangar out there, and that's where they put 95% of that. Kenny Maxwell told me in an interview in my book, 1,000 Years for Revenge, go to peterlance.com. Kenny said, Peter, he said, I got to tell you, it still gnaws at me. I said, what, Ken? He said, the fact that we never found the 10th cargo door. I said, what are you talking about? He said, we found RDX on the aft cargo curtain in the cargo hold, and we found 9 of the doors, but we never found the 10th door, and we found a distress to the metal skin pushing outward, suggesting an explosion of some kind, and we found this, explosives all over the plane. And I was told to shut it down. At a certain point, there was pressure from Washington, from the Bureau, to shut it down. Okay, they were spending too much money. And he said, shut it down. We don't shut things down until we get to the truth. Shut it down, Kenny. Well, anyway, how do you think the FBI, when they finally rolled over and they sided with the theory of the NTSB, how do you think the FBI justified the presence of high explosives on that plane?
How did they do it?
They said that there had been a test in St. Louis 5 weeks earlier by a local cop in an airport with a bomb-sniffing dog, and that the cop had placed bait, if you will, explosives in certain containers in a zigzag pattern around the plane so that the dog could go and find them, right? And they actually had the public, they're asking us to believe that somehow the bait spilled, and that even when it spilled, that the residue of the chemicals somehow embedded themselves in the cushions of the. And by the way, they were found along the 25th row. Remember where I told you Youssef wanted to plant the bomb? He planted the test bomb in the Philippines in the 26th row, but they actually found in the carpeting along the 26th row, and they also found in the aft cargo hold where the dog never went. But in any event, that's how the FBI explained it, that somehow this guy, this cop, had... Now, since my book has come out, and this is going to be in the new book, and this is like a headline that I think is absolutely extraordinary. Let's just say the police officer involved was spoken to, and the police officer involved has said, quote, I did not tell the FBI that the flight that I knew for sure that the flight that became TWA-800 was the flight that I did the test on. In fact, to the best of my recollection, according to my notes, it was not. There were two identical 747s at gate 50 that day in St. Louis 5 weeks before the fatal flight went down, and I did a test on an empty aircraft. Of course he would do it on empty. You're not going to do a bomb-sniffing dog test on a plane that's filling up with passengers, right? As it turned out, according to this officer's notes, the flight that became TW-800 took off only 20 minutes after he finished his test, and by then, it would have been fully crewed, it would have been fully catered, and there would have been a third of the passengers come streaming on board. So it could not have been the type. And he told that to the FBI. He told them, to the best of his knowledge, it wasn't that. But the FBI needed to justify that explosive on that flight in order to roll over the single bullet theory. They had to justify it as being from the bomb-sniffing dog, and therefore... they distorted the evidence, in my opinion.
Are you suggesting that the FBI is not always forthcoming and that they are not always telling the American people the truth?
Well, I'm not going to generalize. I'm going to just I take them as I see them.
Right.
I know you're pulling my leg here, but the point is, in this case, I think it's phenomenal. Now, so look, here's the deal. What happened the next day? Mistrial, Your Honor. Mistrial. Ramsey's standing in front of Judge Duffy. I want a mistrial. Why? Because, Your Honor, this plane blew up last night. The identical scenario of the Bojinka plot. There's got to be a mistrial. Well, Judge Duffy was a salty old Irishman who had already presided over one trial and decided no way is he going to let Youssef roll, and he denied the mistrial. But there are three elements that lead you to believe that this was Youssef. One, could have gotten a mistrial. Two, his ego, that he was actually able to take down a plane and perfect the Bojinka plot that he didn't in the Philippines. And the third thing, and the most important thing, was the massive strategic victory that Al-Qaeda achieved with TWA 800. Even by not taking credit for it, they diverted almost 1,000 FBI agents. Between that and Oklahoma City, for 2 years, the FBI was sucked away from the war on terror. Now think about that. How brilliant a strategic move it was for Bin Laden and company.
Well, now, there's a book called Bin Laden, the Man Who Declared War Against America by Joseph Badansky, who directs the Task Force on Terrorism and Unconventional Warfare for the Republicans in the House of Representatives. In his book, he actually says that Al-Qaeda did take, or at least the radical Islamists did take credit for bringing down TW-800. Now, we never saw that in America, any press in America, but this apparently, at least according to Badansky, was actually published in papers in Europe.
Well, there was. You know, the reason I said they didn't take credit was I was speaking specifically about Yusuf's particular group.
Okay.
There were radical Islamics that took credit for it, and in fact, Roy Kulchar, who was representing Yusuf at kind of as his lawyer, and you know, his second seat, if you will, because Judge Duffy insisted that if he represented himself, he needed a real lawyer on his wing, you know, to protect him, protect his rights, and that's the beauty of our system, that even the most scurrilous of the accused gets a good defense. Youssef Kulchar went and he said to the judge that he had heard a report on ABC World News Tonight with Peter Jennings that in fact someone had taken credit for it on behalf of Youssef. I could never pin it down. I could never find specific references. Not to say they didn't exist and not to say that Youssef Badansky isn't right. But even if they didn't take credit, or if they did, the point is that they were able to, if they did this, and I believe they did, and I believe that a phone call that Youssef was able to get out to Khalid Sheikh, he may have said to Khalid Sheikh, look, I'm coming up with this crucial evidence. Why don't you knock a plane out of the sky? And the plane had come from Athens. How easy would it have been for Khalid Sheikh, who was one of the four Bojinka people? He knew how to build a device, right? He was one of the four guys that just hadn't been caught yet. How easy it would have been in Athens, where the security was more lax in 1996 July, get on board a flight while it's being catered and set this Casio watch X number of hours ahead. And these guys are so smart, you know, assuming that it blew, I mean, if it took off precisely when it was supposed to, they could have actually timed it to blow over the water, which would have made it more difficult to recover debris. Anyway.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment, and so we'll just go ahead a little bit more, and we'll take some that calls in a few minutes, but I really want to get as much of this information as I can, because I've interviewed Peter a number of times before, and I'm learning all sorts of new things tonight. All of it's in the book, however, but I want to get it on tape so that you can understand more clearly what we're really up against. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Our guest this evening is Peter Lance's book, 1,000 Years for Revenge. And, of course, you can go to his website, peterlance.com. That's peterlance.com. And get ever so much more fascinating information. That's really a very, very nice-looking website you have there.
Thank you.
All right. Well, then, of course, it's your contention then that they had actually probably planted a bomb on the plane. Do you think that would explain what happened? And
yeah,
the timing was so close to, you know, right in the middle of Ramzi Yousef's trial, you know, as you say, just the day before he's going to be the presenting evidence there?
Right, absolutely. Like I say, it could have been a mistrial. It would have been the fulfillment of his original plot. And he was a great egomaniac, as many geniuses are. So it would have proven to the world that it was, or at least to his people, that he could have, that this thing would have been possible. And by the way, you know, another element of why Yousef might have fought Nichols. Yousef was very generous with his bomb making skills. He actually had three stoves that were in boxes, were unused, getting ready to go to, later Murad testified they were going to give one to the Egyptians, one to the Algerians, and one he was going to bring to France to teach the radical brothers in those countries how to build bombs. And that's why, and he tried to teach the Abu Sayyaf, although he claimed that they were kind of not that adept at bomb building in the Philippines, but he easily could have been a mentor to Terry Nichols and McVeigh in their plot. And again, it's like the surrogate, it's like create havoc in the United States. You know that there's an enormous Islamic population, or a large Islamic population, in Oklahoma City because of the oil industry. There always has been. And in fact, there was a famous Islamic conference there in 1989 where Abu Alima, the red-headed Egyptian who was one of the co-conspirators with Yousef, actually met Wadi al-Hajj, and Wadi al-Hajj was the famous co-conspirator from Tucson, from another al-Kifah, another center that was a part of the MAK network, who went on to become bin Laden's personal secretary in the Sudan and was convicted in the African embassy bombing conspiracy. So, you know, these guys had been familiar with Oklahoma City. So, again, this stuff is just not that far-fetched. It's when you fully connect the dots on what an incredible adversary Ramzi Yousef was, you begin to it becomes more plausible. And Nancy Floyd, who I later spoke to after the book was written, and I hadn't heard from her in a while, and I had no idea what she thought of the book, and, you know, as I said, I got her story through confidential sources for the first time, the story of this heroic FBI agent had never been told. And she called me one Friday night, and she made my month by telling me how much she enjoyed the book. And of all the things she said, you know something, Peter, you really convinced me on TWA 800. She said, I worked that case, and I'm, you know, she said, you made a believer out of me. So this is from a very seasoned FBI agent who had recruited arguably one of the most valuable assets ever in the history of the early war on terror, Nancy Floyd, and she gave me that kind of endorsement for this theory. So again, we don't know. We weren't in the room with the guys. We can't prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. At least I can't right now because I'm just a journalist. I don't have subpoena power. But when you just read it and line up the dots, your jaw will drop when you see how capable Yousef was.
And, of course, the timing is really such an interesting coincidence, and perhaps much more than coincidence. And certainly Nancy Floyd, for our listeners who didn't hear the beginning remarks, Nancy Floyd was the FBI agent who had actually recruited Salem Ahmad Salam.
Salam, yeah.
Initially, and she really got sort of a bad rap over that. She was working one unit. I think she was in the having to do with communism. She was spending her nights on her own counseling Salam before, you know, because he was ready to drop out half a dozen times or maybe more often than that. And she kept him there, and of course he had confidence in her. He was the only person in the FBI he really did trust.
Absolutely. He wasn't wearing a wire, and that was the deal that he had made with these guys, not to wear a wire. And he would be a pure intelligence asset, and there's a real tradition of that in the Bureau. And those people burrow deeply, and when they get a sense of what the threat is, then the Bureau comes in and sets up traditional surveillance, and they get probable cause, and they go in and they make a criminal case. And they never have to give up a guy like Salem, an asset. An informant is a different issue. Well, what happened was Nancy had this incredible guy who went and risked his life, American naturalized Egyptian citizen, who infiltrated the blind sheikh's cell. And basically, you know, just within 2 days, They gave him 6 weeks to infiltrate the cell, and he did it within 2 days. And basically within days, he's riding with the Sheikh to Detroit, where the Sheikh is asking him to kill Mubarak, the president of Egypt. And he becomes aware of this plot to blow up 12 Jewish locations around New York City. That's what they called it, the 12 Jewish locations plot. And warns the Bureau through Nancy, and then this new head of terrorism comes in, Carson Dunbar, who was like a paper guy in the office, had no terrorism experience, had virtually no investigative experience, had been a state trooper in New Jersey, and had worked his way up in the New York office, was kind of a desk jockey, and basically, he did not like Salem. He did not like Floyd. It was like a personality issue. And he turned the tables on him. He said, "You have to wear a wire." And Salem said, "What are you talking about? That's not why I was recruited. I have family in Egypt. They'd be in danger. I can't do this." And basically, he left. He withdrew. They gave him 3 months to withdraw. And, when he left, then the Sheikh made a phone call to Pakistan, and Ramzi Youssef came in, and the plot then morphed and escalated from the 12 Jewish locations plot to the World Trade Center bombing conspiracy. Youssef snuck into the country, not snuck in, I mean, how he got in is another amazing story in my book, as you'll agree. Came into Kennedy Airport September 1, 1992, and claimed political asylum, and his partner, Mohammed Ajaj, had bomb books and everything with him, and even though they flew together in first class, and even though in a very alert INS agent, a woman, and by the way, there are dozens of instances in the course of this 12-year period where women intervened and almost turned the tide. Nancy was one, this INS agent was another one, Benazir Bhutto, the president of Pakistan, who Youssef tried to kill, was one, Ida Farskal, this alert police officer in the Philippines, was another, Ronnie Buka's wife, Eve, was another. Incredible how women played such an important role and were thwarted, people did not take their advice, and we saw what happened. Well, anyway, Youssef sneaks in and gets in and starts to build a bomb, and now Salem has been out of it for a few months, tells Nancy when he meets her to get his last $500, they were paying him $500 a week. He said, "There's something going on. I don't know what it is. Follow Mahmoud Abdelima, the big red-headed Egyptian. Follow Mohammed Salema, the little Palestinian. They will take you to whatever the danger is. You're the FBI, Nancy. Do what you do best." She said, "Look, I'm out of it. I've been warned off by Carson Dunbar. I'll pass this on, but I'm pretty much out of this now. I've had my wings clipped." And he said, "All right, but if you do not do this, don't call me when the bombs, plural, go off." That's the last thing he said to her, October or so of 92. The day of the bombing, the day after the bombing, they brought him back, frantically re-recruited him. The Bureau paid him $1.5 million to do what he could have done in the fall of 1992. And he, in 2 months, set up a sting operation. They did the traditional FBI surveillance, special operations group, the black bag unit that got Gotti, the same guys, and they set up a sting, and he rounded up the blind Sheikh and 12 others in a plot to blow up the bridges and tunnels around Manhattan. They paid him $1.5 million to do what he could have done for $500 in the fall of 92. Only Carson Dunbar didn't trust him. To this day, when I interviewed Carson Dunbar a second time this summer for my book, the last thing he said to me is, "Peter, do you know what his job was in the hotel when Nancy recruited him?" I said, "No, Carson, what was it?" "He was an elevator operator." If that matters, you know, like, who cares? He was a security guard. He was an elevator operator. He did maintenance in the building. You know, who cares? The guy infiltrated the blind Sheikh's cell. Yet Carson Dunbar, who is in this incredible position of power in the New York office of the FBI, to this day is downing Ahmad Salem, the linchpin witness of the federal government in the Day of Terror trial, and he's downing him. Why? Because he underestimated him and refused to take his advice, and they could have stopped the Trade Center bombing in 92. They would have stopped 6 people, including 7, if you include the unborn child of Monica Smith, would be alive. 1,000 people would not have been injured. $500 million of damage would not have been done. They would have captured the Mozart of terror, Ramzi Youssef, in 92. They would have stopped 9/11. Okay? That's what I say in my book. And I challenge Director Mueller and anybody in the FBI to find anything wrong with my evidence. Tell me I'm wrong. I've asked them for weeks and months. I haven't heard a word out of them except for some snide comment from the press flack in the New York office calling my book a rehash of old stories. Well, rehash is, would be difficult because no one has told Nancy's story before. John Miller's book, The Cell, never even mentioned Nancy Floyd by name, and no one has ever told Ronnie Buca's story, the third hero in our book, the second hero in our book. So
why don't you tell that story? Because I think that's such an important story, and the average person, I've never heard of Ronald Buca.
Yeah, and Ronnie Buca, you know, my book is constructed, again, for those that are listening and they're thinking, well, you know, this is going to be a complicated book about terrorism with a lot of unpronounceable Middle Eastern names, and I don't know if we're... No, this book, and I think Dr. Stan will tell you, reads like a page-turning Tom Clancy novel, because what I did was I took the story of these three people, and the book is constructed somewhat like the film Traffic, in that it intercuts the stories of these three people. Only it's true. Ramzi Youssef, who you've heard about, Nancy Floyd, who's trying to find, stop him from the inside of the Bureau and being thwarted from the inside, and Ronnie Buca, this incredible fire marshal for the FDNY. Now, here's Ronnie's story. I was with at dinner last night with the husband of a well-known actress, American actress, kind of an icon. I don't want to say who she was, but she's just a beautiful woman, made two of the greatest movies ever made, and her husband is the producer, read my book, and he said, Peter, your book is like five books, you know? And the story of Ronnie could be a book in itself. And here's the story. Ronnie Buca is an ex-Green Beret. He was in, he joined the fire department in the early, late 70s. In 1986, he got into Rescue One, which is the greatest heavy rescue company in the world, based in Midtown Manhattan. They do 700 to 900 working fires a year, and every firefighter in the United States knows about Rescue One. I mean, they were the first true great heavy rescue company. Most others are modeled after them. And goes up to what they do. Their job is to go into buildings to help advance the hose of the fire suppression units and to look for bodies, people, victims, and members of service who may be down, and get them out. And Ronnie went into this tenement on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Five-story tenement, ran up to the roof, supposed to vent the roof, poke holes in it. When a lieutenant is trapped on the fifth floor, the fire ground is on the fourth floor, and the fifth floor is a skillet, and this guy is going to die soon. Ronnie goes over onto a fire escape and reaches over with a Halligan tool, a forcible entry tool, to try and pop open scissor gates, as would only happen in New York. They have gates across the window that are locked to keep the bad guys out, only now this lieutenant can't escape because he's going to burn to death. So Ronnie is reaching over to try and pop the gates when he falls five stories down. He's falling on his back, and on the second story he flips over, hits a conduit, and lands on his knees and breaks his back, is not expected to live. The greatest midday rescue in the history of the fire department, they rush him to Bellevue across town, down Fifth Avenue, and the cardinal shows up, the mayor shows up, a big story, he's not expected to live. Ronnie Buca, not only could have he retired on a three-quarter tax-free pension, which is the holy grail of the fire department, and he would have deserved it because he was 32 years old and he broke his back and is not, you know, he's expected to at least, even if he recovered, be a cripple. In 1 year, Stan, he went back not only to the fire department but to rescue, which is a rocky story in itself. So he was known as the flying firefighter, a legend. After he hurt his back, he'd always been a paratrooper in the Army Reserve in the 101st Airborne. And this guy is the best we have in America. Ronnie Buca represents the best. And he hurt his back, so he put in for a military intelligence unit. And his unit was one of four units in the entire country tasked to support DIAC, the Defense Intelligence Analysis Center, at Bowling Air Force Base in Washington. They call it the Death Star. It's like the CIA of the Pentagon. And Ronnie had top secret security clearance, okay? Now, I could not have made this up in a million years, but on the day of the World Trade Center bombing in 1993, he had since become a fire marshal, an investigator. Who goes into the hole, the four-story pit created by Ramzi Youssef, but a firefighter from Rescue One, who was one of Ronnie's oldest friends named Kevin Shea, falls down into this pit and impales his leg on rebar and almost dies. Exploding cars are like falling off the ramps. I have a scene that you've never heard, you've never read anything like it before. I get Kevin's first-hand account of the World Trade Center bombing, what it was like to be in that pit that Ramzi Youssef had created. Now, while this is happening, Youssef has fled to Kennedy Airport, and he's waiting. The clock is ticking as they're delaying the flights, and he's waiting to see if he can get out. Ronnie Bucca that night goes to see Kevin at Beekman Downtown Hospital, brought him a shake from McDonald's, who's to call him Round, as in round peg fitting into a square hole, because he and Kevin were mavericks in the department. And he said, Kevin, I'm going to find whoever did this. Actually, I'm a fire marshal. Of course, they've got to, the FBI's got to include us. This is the biggest arson fire in New York history. Well, guess what? Except for two token marshals, they excluded the fire department, the FBI, and their arrogance. And Ronnie did not get to investigate the fire where it almost cost the life of his friend, okay? And punched a hole into the town he loved and grew up in, Manhattan, okay? So on his own, Dr. Stan, representing the best and brightest that we have in this country, this guy worked mutual tours, back-to-back 24-hour tours, would sleep in firehouses, go to the New York Public Library, and educated himself on the history of Islamic terror, and became convinced in 1994, 93, that these men would come back to finish the job. It was an obsession, a beautiful obsession. Tried to join the Joint Terrorist Task Force, which was set up specifically to partner FBI agents in New York with seasoned local law investigators, but because he was a fire marshal, and they looked down on fire marshals in law enforcement and the police department, there's a rivalry between the Reds and the Blues, not unlike the rivalry between the CIA and the FBI, and he was spurned. He was not allowed to, you know, be part of the hunt. Well, guess what? By some strange irony, in 1999, September, he was working at Metrotech, the brand new headquarters of the fire department, when he overhears that an Egyptian-American accountant named Ahmed Amin Rafai, who's been with the department by then 25 years, and an accountant, has somehow lost his ID. And then he finds, Ronnie investigates, finds out the guy lied to get a second ID to get into this highly secure building. Further, he finds out, astonishingly, that this guy Rafai obtained the blueprints of the World Trade Center in 1992 prior to the bombing. But the biggest headline of all, and what should have been in the front page of the New York Times when my book came out, and to this day I don't understand why no one has picked up on this. Ronnie Bucca found videotape of this guy arm in arm with the blind sheikh, Omar Abdel Rahman, the guy that I told you was the intimate of bin Laden, the guy who was the spiritual advisor to Ramzi Youssef in the plot to blow up the Trade Center, to blow up the bridges and tunnels. This guy, if we're ever to get a look at the presidential daily briefing of August 6th, 5 weeks before 9/11, reportedly there's a reference to a British intelligence report about a plot to hijack a plane to free the blind sheikh. 5 days before 9/11, the Taliban in Afghanistan offered to exchange the blind sheikh, then in federal prison, for the 8 Christian aid workers that were in Kabul at the time, if you remember that. The blind sheikh runs like a hot circuit cable through this story from 1989 in Afghanistan with bin Laden all the way through the World Trade Center bombing 1 and 9/11. And here is an Egyptian-American, intimate of him, holding his arm, whispering in his ear, on video, walking through town, working for the fire department, who gets the blueprints of the World Trade Center prior to the bombing. And in 1999, Ronnie finds this out. What's going on in the world in 1999? Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is in Hamburg, Germany, finalizing with Mohammed Atta the plot, training men on flight simulators to finalize the 9/11 plot. Okay? What would have happened if the Bureau had taken seriously this evidence from Ronnie Bucca and begun to look all the way back at the original Nocer investigation and the, you know, it's what I did in my book. What would have happened if they in 1999 had done what I did in my book retrospectively, right? Well, guess what? The Bureau blew it off. Ronnie Bucca was devastated. They weren't interested. They weren't interested in evidence that an Egyptian inside the fire department had trained the plans of the Trade Center ahead of time, was an intimate of the sheikh, and was now trying to get a second ID to this building that had all the plans of all the major buildings in New York City. Okay? Can you believe it? And then Ronnie Bucca, I could not make this up, on 9/11, even though he's a fire marshal, even though he's not in a fire company, knew that tower like the house he grew up in. As soon as the plane hit the first tower, he rushed downtown with his boss, ran up the tower, and made it up to the 78th floor of the South Tower with a battalion chief named Oriol Palmer. And now radio tapes recovered prove that Ronnie Bucca made it higher than any other firefighter except for Chief Palmer that day. In either tower, they found a standpipe hose, they charged it, they found pressure, they were fighting the flames, and they died with their boots on. okay? The man that people talk about, John O'Neill, the man who knew. Ronnie Booker was telling people they're going to hit the Trade Center in 1993, within months of the original bombing. And he was spurned by the FBI only to die on 9/11. And his widow, Eve, when she finally went through his locker, found a file marked the towers, his beautifully obsessive file, which had the report, the face sheet from the fire department on this guy, Rafai. She brought it to the FBI. They then brought it to the Bureau a second time. And this is after 9/11, and the Bureau blows it off again. And then last summer when I was investigating the case, and I nailed it down, I sent it to a guy in Homeland Security in Washington, because I'm an American first and a journalist second, and I was concerned about the potential of this guy being a sleeper for Al-Qaeda. He had retired from the fire department, but he was still around, and they reopened the case in the fall of 2002. But guess what? They assigned a rookie agent to the case, and to this day, he's in the wind. I interviewed him last July 8th, Rafai, in New Jersey. He apparently has taken off for Egypt since, and he's in the wind, you know, and to this day, we don't know what role he may or may not have played with the blind sheikh in this entire conspiracy.
And I think that people have to understand that this is just one massive conspiracy with all sorts of arms like a tentacle, but wrapped around various important parts of our society. And really, how all of these various people interlock. But one of the things that's really always really disturbed me is the fact that the CIA was involved in bringing the blind sheikh to America. He was a known terrorist. He was living in Egypt. He had been imprisoned. In fact, I have one book, Unholy Wars, talks about how the people over there believe that the CIA had actually gotten the blind sheikh out of prison, out of the Egyptian prisons, and then the CIA brings him to America. Why would the CIA do anything that stupid unintentionally?
Well, you know, again, when you read my book, what you will see is what looks like a pattern of extraordinary, gross, gross negligence. And the women, a number of the widows of 9/11, who are the subject of my new book, and these women are incredible. They are making our Constitution work. They're putting the fire to the feet of the 9/11 commissioners. They're demanding full disclosure, and they're doing our job for us, you know. And many of them believe that it's gone beyond incompetence to not participation in the sense that the administration actually plotted and planned the attacks, but gross negligence in allowing the attacks to happen. And the more I study this, and the day of, and the more I look at how NORAD and the response of the planes, the difference between that response and any typical response of an unknown aircraft in the 2 years prior, the fact that there were four of them, the fact that the president waited, when he was whispered to by Andrew Card, he already knew, that was the second plane that it hit. You understand? He knew that two planes were off the radar at that point, and he stayed in that school and listened to a story about a goat for the next 30-some minutes. I mean, he's the commander-in-chief, okay? The Donald Rumsfeld stayed in his office in the Pentagon instead of going to the war room, if you will. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Meyer, chairman designate, was on Capitol Hill behind closed doors. The three guys that had the power to shoot down an airliner, our country was under attack. And why? There are all these unanswered questions. I mean, among them, why did the story of the puts and calls on the extraordinary trading that was done in not only United stock, but American stock in the days leading up to 9/11, 6 to 10 times the number of bets, the puts that were betting the stock would go down compared to any other airline. Not only that, 6 to 10 times puts put on the stock of AXA Advisor and Swiss Re, the two reinsurers of the Trade Center. Now that's a crosshair. I mean, when you have the people betting that the stock of the two reinsurers of the Trade Center will go down 6 to 10 times more than any other reinsurer, and you have people, again, this is alleged now, this is what was supposed to have been investigated by the SEC, and we haven't heard a word about it. There was supposedly a perfunctory investigation. The Wall Street Asian Journal, I found one story saying, well, we looked into it, there was nothing there. Well, if there's nothing there, then show the American people. The easiest thing in the world is to prove who bought stock. Was it just the Bin Laden group? Or were there other people that may have had prior knowledge? I mean, this is like this is easy stuff, you know? And 2 years after the fact, we still don't know the answer to that. We still haven't found all the black boxes, or if they found them, they reportedly have not found four of the black boxes from the Trade Center site yet they found almost undamaged the passport of one of the hijackers at the site. I mean, difficult to explain. Why did number 7 World Trade Center go down? A 49-story office building, the only other building in the entire perimeter around the World Trade Center. Other buildings were interdicted. They had their facades pierced by burning debris. No other building caught on fire and went down, yet this is the building north of the Trade Center complex across BC Street that housed the city's command center. There was, an investigation alleged that the fuel tanks, the diesel fuel tanks for the generators caught fire. Well, how could the diesel fuel tanks catch fire if they're in an area of the building way, way into the building beyond where any flaming debris was? You know, again, there are this extraordinary number of unanswered questions, and I am not in the game of conspiracy. I'm not some wide-eyed conspiracy theorist. I'm a hardened investigative reporter. I look at facts. I have a law degree from Fordham University Law School, and I like to say the facts. I'm in a Joe Friday approach to journalism, but I have to tell you, there are so many amazing unanswered questions regarding that day, the day of, which is what my new book is about, that you just have to applaud these women. And here's the problem. Right now, you have a White House that's made a sweetheart deal with the commission so that they're not going to see, not all 10 commissioners are going to get to look at these classified documents. They're going to have a committee of 2 that's going to report to a committee of 4 that the White House can edit the report. Then they're going to report to the full 10. Why not have full disclosure? They all have top secret clearance. They can all go into a room and look at these documents. Why? What does the Bush administration have to hide? Why is Condoleezza Rice now saying over the weekend she doesn't want to testify under oath in open session? Why not? She's a national security advisor. This is the greatest intelligence failure since the Trojan horse. Forget Pearl Harbor. Why shouldn't she be brought in front of the American people on the last great official investigative body charged with solving the greatest unsolved murder in American history? And maybe that's how we'll end the program.
Well, I think it's the questions that need to be asked. And of course, when you were talking about where the president was on the morning of September 11th, where the Secretary of Defense was, Donald Rumsfeld, where the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that sounded like Mindy Kleinberg's testimony before the Senate committee earlier this year.
Exactly, the commission, or the joint inquiry.
And so I'm really looking forward to the book, and when can we expect to have something on that?
Well, you know, that's what my editor's asking me. You know, a lot of it will depend on the timing of the 9/11 commission, because if the 9/11 commission is going to hold to this May 27th deadline, and I don't know how they can do a thorough job and hold to that deadline, if they don't vote for delay to get more time and resources, then I'm not sure whether I'll come out around the time of the report in May or whether I'll come out in September prior to the election, but it'll definitely be in enough time for the American people to look at the book, and I'm going to write it in a very simple way. It's going to be about half the length of my current book, and it's going to raise and at least point us in the direction of some answers on some of these extraordinary questions about the day of. Sunlight is the best disinfectant. I mean, as Justice Cardozo said, and, you know, people should be demanding a vigorous press. We should be demanding challenging any administration in power. That's what makes a vigorous democracy. I applaud you, Dr. Stan, for the kind of questions you ask and for giving me a chance to come on. And PeterLance.com is the site. 1,000 Years for Revenge is the book. And I'll come on anytime you want me.
God bless you. Thanks so very much. It's been a fascinating hour. Good night, and thanks
so
much again. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Okay, fine. That was Peter Lance. I hope you enjoyed it. One of the great interviews we've had recently. And so until tomorrow at the same time, pray for America, pray for revival, pray for Radio Liberty.